Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August 3rd, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Dan Height. Today's session number is 1 and is titled Nonviolent Conflict Resolution. Let's listen in.
Height, ninth degree black belt, and the topic is diffusing potentially violent situations without the use of force. I'm very happy to be here. I'm in fact honored that the Holden staff invited me to meet with all of you today. I met with the miners on Wednesday, and the response was great. I really had a great time with the young people, and they asked probably some of the best questions that I've ever been asked in probably 40 or 50 schools that I've been to around the country. Some pretty heavy questions, pretty serious, and I'll even touch on a few of those this morning. Now, I would imagine that there might be one or two of you out here that are wondering, what is this guy doing here? Don't we have enough violence in this world, enough violence in the streets, enough violence in our schools, enough violence in the workplace, that we've got to invite some karate expert with all these specialized areas of training to come here and talk to us about nonviolence or ways to defuse violent situations? As the Holden staff lost their mind inviting a guy like this? And on top of this, he's a professional bodyguard, a somewhat violent profession. And we all know about bodyguards. We remember that the Tonya Harding situation where her bodyguard was instrumental in setting up the attack on Nancy Kerrigan. I mean, who knows? Maybe I'm a graduate of the Tonya Harding School of Bodyguards. It's possible. Well, in the moments ahead, I'd like to take all of you on a journey. And I thought the best way to help you get to know me a little bit better and maybe how I've changed over the years after protecting people for over 26 years, is to focus a little bit on some of the questions that I've received in the last few years, and especially up here at Holden. I go through the questions pretty quick, but it'll give you an idea maybe of where I'm coming from, because we start out kind of light, and then the questions get a little heavier, and maybe some of my comments get a little more serious as we lead into some of my, you might say, top 15 or 20 techniques on how to keep yourselves safer, how to get out of violent situations without having to hit someone. And especially when I talk with young people, as I meet with more and more young people, some of them feel that the only way to resolve a conflict is to stab someone or shoot someone. There's no middle ground for mild irritation. They go from 0 to 10 immediately. So I'm trying to give them some options and also explain to them maybe about my work and the fact that I've seen the darker side of life. So one of the first questions I always get, you don't look like a bodyguard. Well, like Kevin Costner said in the movie The Bodyguard, this is my disguise. Most people sometimes think that a bodyguard has to be 7 foot and weigh 400 pounds. Most entertainers, most sports celebrities, anyone that's famous or infamous, really hire people or bodyguards of all sizes. So they can be short, fat, tall, thin, you name it, they're out there. Can you jump over speeding cars? I was asked this the other day. Jump on top of buildings or catch bullets like the Power Rangers? No. Do you get in a fight or a battle every time you go out on a bodyguard job? No, if I did, I'd never get hired by all the entertainers over the years that I have. They want someone that can diffuse situations, calm people down, and I spend 99% of my time trying to keep people from doing stupid things. Can you break wood and concrete and stones and ice and glass with your hands and feet? Yes, but I've never been chased or attacked by any of those items. How accurate was the movie The Bodyguard? Well, I used to tell groups that it's a very accurate movie about my work. and what a bodyguard does, except for falling in love with your client. That's a no-no. Well, then I had a student at one of the schools that I talked to show me this, where Dolly Parton plans to marry her bodyguard, and Roseanne did marry her bodyguard. Well, I want to assure everyone, not just because my wife is in the audience, that I've never had any temptations to jump the fence for Roseanne. Okay. By having a bodyguard, do you guarantee or ensure someone's safety? There are no guarantees in life, even with a bodyguard, but it's better to have one and not need that person than to need one and not have one. For example, John Lennon had just hired a team of bodyguards, but they weren't going to start until the following week. Now, that's not to say he still would not have been shot to death, but maybe the bodyguard could have taken the shot, deflected the shooter, shoved John down on the ground, tackled the shooter. Maybe he wouldn't have been able to empty the gun. The sad thing about it is that John had signed an autograph for this person earlier in the day, and then he came back to kill him. I remember one of the first interviews that the man that did the shooting, he said, "The Beatles changed music, the Beatles changed the world, and I changed the Beatles." And that was his comment or response on why did you do it. Okay, you work with a lot of celebrities, but why do you work with so many controversial people? Well, I didn't bring a lot of the other photographs. I really had not planned on doing this up here. But I usually can ring the room with poster boards of different photographs of people that I've worked with over the years. And there are some people that I'm sure, there's some that I disliked. Or I'm sure there's some you might find that you would hate. I mean, I've worked with people that have done a lot of bad things, but still need protection and sometimes commit a crime and become a celebrity. I mean, only in America. But the reason I work with those people is that Bob Hope had told me years ago, never turn down any client, no matter what. So I've worked with people like Louis Farrakhan of the Black Nation of Islam. I've also worked with people like G. Gordon Liddy, people from Watergate, people from Iran-Contra, you name it, I've been around them. One of the worst people I've ever worked with was Joey Buttafuoco. But only in America could you have a situation where you have an affair with an underage girl. She plans the murder of Joey's wife. Then she goes to prison. Joey's back together, or really they never separated, and now he's going to make movies. I don't understand it. I don't get involved in their politics or religion. I just protect people. When you're not protecting someone, what do you do? Over the last few years, I've been developing a workshop and seminar program that I've been doing around the country, working with school districts, corporations, small business, and a lot of churches. I do some retreats. Anybody that will have me, where I can come in and talk a little bit about violence, anger, conflict, and how to basically better protect yourself, so that you don't have to learn a martial art. And I'm going to go into this a little bit later. Why would some big movie action star need me as a bodyguard? I mean, a lot of these people are much larger, much stronger than me. Why would a pro boxer, a heavyweight champion, want to hire me? You can't watch everybody all the time, and they understand that. We have more and more situations around the country where you have an entertainer signing an autograph and somebody else wanting to try and hit them to say, "I'm the one that knocked out George Foreman. I'm the one that hit Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm the one that showed Kevin Costner he's really not the bodyguard." I mean, you have all different kinds of people now. The other thing is lawsuits. They're sued constantly. And many of them can't afford to hit anyone or defend themselves, and others have never been in a real serious situation in their entire life. They may be an action star, but have never had to defend themselves. And they wouldn't probably like hearing me say that, but. Dan, it doesn't make sense. I got this question a couple times. You're a bodyguard, a karate expert, but you also feel like you're a peacemaker. You believe in nonviolence. It just doesn't seem to fit. 98% of my work centers around keeping people from doing the wrong thing. I try to help them make better choices. Now, I do feel, although I've had some good debates over this, that there is evil in the world, and that there are people that do evil things. I've had some people say, no, they're just misguided. But I've truly met some people that I consider evil. All you have to do is look at the people that are dropping pipe bombs all over the place, or the Oklahoma City bomb, or the Polly Class situation, the little girl that was murdered in Petaluma, California. I mean, I've seen an awful lot of tragedy and evil in my work in the last few years. The evil is an unfortunate reality, and I feel that it's important that you have people that can deal with this evil or deal with people that want to do evil things. And so that's where I kind of see myself fitting in. I try to be as just, as fair, and as remorseful as I can in my work. People have asked, well, aren't you worried about your family and that somebody will come back and seek retribution, retaliation, revenge on your family because you've had to subdue them in a bodyguard situation? Knock on rock, I've never had that happen. And I really believe it's because I showed these people a certain amount of compassion, dignity, and respect. Once I had them subdued, I didn't go overboard. I didn't lose my cool, you might say. I didn't continue beating them or hitting them or something like that, like you see in many cases around the country. I do just enough to control somebody. I have to be like that because of the training. And I'm going to go into that in just a little bit. Another area that comes up is that it's one thing to talk about peace, nonviolence, theoretically. And you can sit in a classroom and discuss these areas, and I've done that many times. It's another thing to be confronted by someone, a complete stranger, that wants to do you harm. Their sole interest in life is to hurt you, or to kill you, to torture you. When you're confronted with that, sometimes some techniques fail. I'm going to try and present here in a little bit some techniques that have not failed for me and my work and for teachers and people on the street and other groups I've met with that have written me saying, hey, it worked. And I'll keep moving here so that I can get onto that area. Prior to the talk that I had with the miners group, I was asked which bodyguard job had the most impact on me. And I think they expected it would be the times that I've been hurt, but it really wasn't. The one job that had the most impact on me was working with the father of Polly Class, Mark Class. This is the little girl from Petaluma, California, taken in the night during a slumber party, and that's a picture of Mark and I at one of their memorials. She was taken in the night by a career criminal who'd already been serving time for attacking and torturing two other women. He took her out into a wooded area, murdered her, and buried her under a woodpile. Mark's dad received threats because he was trying to change some laws about especially having to do with people that are career criminals that commit serious or violent offenses against children. And, you know, immediately he received some pretty serious threats. Mark told me that Polly was a great kid. She was ready to explode on the world and just shine. She wanted to work with senior citizens. She wanted to make a difference. The happiest day of Mark's life is when Polly was born. Teachers that Polly had said that she was like a precious gem. She loved to play the clarinet. And you know, Dan, she did a mean rendition of Elvis singing, and she also had a maternal instinct. Maybe that's why the night of the kidnapping, that during the slumber party when they were tied up and gagged, she did not resist as a way of letting her two friends remain in the house. What amazed me was that the killer now has a fan club. Several offers of marriage while awaiting his trial. And Mark, Polly's father, received threats, as I said before. And what really troubled me was, here's a guy who takes the police to Polly's body, confesses to the crime. It takes almost 3 years to come to trial, 2 years to select a jury, and when it's over, it may cost the state of California over $16 million. One of the girls in the minors group asked me on Wednesday, do you ever get a little upset about some of these things, or depressed, or overwhelmed? I went to Ann, I think it's Pedersen's class, and she mentioned last night that sometimes people get overwhelmed by evil. I think that's an area, because there were many talks that I've given where I could not even discuss this. It was just too painful, because I'll never forget the pain, the agony, the sadness in the eyes of Polly's family. And one of my regrets, and I'd give up working with all the celebrities if I could have been there for Polly. So that's one of my disappointments in my career. How has your work as a bodyguard changed over the years? Years ago, all you had to do was worry about the girl that was in love with the drummer of the Beach Boys. Now you have to worry about predators, stalkers. And CBS News just recently talked a little bit about what they call the super predator, that this person plans to make its major debut the latter part of this year and through 97. A super predator is a person that just enjoys killing, doesn't want to rob you, doesn't want anything from you, doesn't want to sexually assault you or take money from you or any goods that you might, or products or things that you have in your home. He just wants to kill somebody and then move on to the next. Indiscriminate killing of people. Well, obviously that really bothers me. And it almost ties in with why there's been such an increase in qualifications for my work. It almost mirrors how violent our society has become. Now you need threat assessment analysis training and pre-assault assessment training and the advanced first aid and then all of the terrible things that I many times avoid even talking about. But you have to be an expert in weapons, in knife fighting, joint relocation, joint fracture training, nerve center manipulation. I mean, all this terrible stuff. And I can look back at years ago when I started, it was so easy. It was fun. There wasn't the threat that you see now. The other surprise that I've had, or disappointment, is that I'm not just protecting celebrities anymore, or getting requests, or where they're requesting help or advice. I'm getting requests from school teachers. You'll find letters there. School counselors. I've done several programs for school counselors around the country, from where I live in Idaho to Appleton, Wisconsin. School administrators, doctors, lawyers. A lot of people always go, well, I can see why lawyers need. But retired military personnel, mainly generals. I've worked with a lot of generals over the years. School board members, small business owners, the clergy, and professional athletes. And some people are surprised when I say the clergy, but there are pastors and priests that do receive serious threats and are concerned about their safety. And obviously, we've all read about many that have been murdered for various political views that they might hold or religious views. I'm even getting requests for advice from families going on vacation because some of our national parks have become so dangerous. Some of our theme parks have become dangerous and riddled with gangs. And families are afraid now to even go to some of these areas. They just had an article about Yosemite, that you want to be real careful when you're camping out there at night in a tent. It can be real dangerous. And to top it off, I've been invited by a lot of school districts around the country to help them plan or organize or design booklets on dealing with kidnap and hostage situations. I never thought I'd see this in my lifetime. Booklets like this. I do some team teaching with a man by the name of Max Excel. Now, Max was the principal of a school in Cokeville, Wyoming. And one day he went to the post office, and while he was at the post office, a husband and wife moved in a grocery cart a huge 7-stage bomb. They took over his school. He walked back in. The janitor was upset, wondering why all the teachers had left their classroom in such a mess. The nice thing that, and the reason I tell you this quick story, is that Max did everything right when he came into the school. He eventually got down to the classroom, a room about this size, 150 people packed in there, everybody sweating. And here's this husband and wife with this massive bomb, 2 5-gallon cans of gasoline, nitroglycerin, dynamite, deck screws, nails, gunpowder, you name it, and a box of ammunition. All of this linked together. He'd already tested the bomb. Max walked in, and the guy said, "It's time for a revolution. I'm going to blow this school up and kill everybody unless I get $308 million. I want $1 million for every day that I worked for Cokeville." He was a former police officer, had been fired. And he said, "Someday Cokeville will pay." Now, the bomb was set up with string around the wrist tied to the bomb with a clothespin. If the clothespin opened, the bomb detonated. Well, Max walked up to him and he said, "How can I help you?" Rather than confront him, rather than challenge him like many administrators and teachers have done, "Oh, that's probably not a real bomb. That shotgun's probably not even loaded. That's probably a toy handgun." So rather than challenge and make fun and confront, "How can I help you? Who can I call? Is there anybody I can call?" The guy had a whole list. Most of these guys that I've had problems with, or Max, they want to talk to somebody. They've got a whole list of things to say. So he started to calm down. The bomber and his wife started to calm down. "Yeah, I want you to call the sheriff, the governor, the president, this whole list." Max said, "I'll do it right now. Can I leave the room?" "Yeah." So Max went down and called the FBI, the ATF, the police, the sheriff's department, everybody, the emergency medical department. The amazing thing about this story is that the director of emergency management planning for the U.S. government, federal government, was in Cokeville that day on a training session. So, I mean, that was like another miracle in this whole case. The sad thing was that Max continued to work with these people and doing everything right, but the father had to go to the restroom. So he took the rope off his wrist and put it on his wife's wrist, and he left the room to go to the bathroom. And so did Max, because they wanted a case of Kleenex. And because people were getting sick, the gas fumes were filling the room and people were throwing up. Well, here goes Max out of the room, the father out of the room. About that time, the news comes on live from Cokeville, Wyoming. Hostage situation, 150 people being held hostage, and the wife turned to watch the show and detonated the bomb. Now, another miracle, only the gasoline went off. They don't know why to this day. It burned 90 kids and teachers, 19 or 20 with second and third degree burns. But all of the kids and teachers lived. The only people that died in this were the husband and wife. The husband came back in the room, saw his wife on fire, shot her, and then went in the restroom and committed suicide. The moral of this story is that up to the accidental detonation, Max Excel, who is now an administrator or superintendent of schools in Shoshone, Idaho, did everything right. It's part of what I teach. And so we really linked up. We really worked well together. He tells his story, shows a video, and then I come in and do my thing. And it's been great. Another example, just a few weeks ago, prior to the Olympics, I was invited to the U.S. National Gymnastics Championships in Knoxville, Tennessee. Why? They wanted me to evaluate security because so many of our young gymnasts are receiving serious threats. Shannon Miller has a person following her. Dominic Moshinu has a couple different guys in their 50s that are saying, marry me or I'll kill you. So it's changed the face of gymnastics, and it's also changed the face of many other sports. I mean, some of these kids are just junior high and high school gymnasts. They aren't famous. Now, Shannon Miller is, but there are many that have been threatened that aren't celebrities and are receiving serious threats, and the predators are kind of coming out of the woodwork. Again, I hate to repeat myself, but I never thought I'd see some of this in my lifetime. I get interviewed a lot on radio and television, whatever part of the country we've lived in. And some of the radio talk shows that I'm on, obviously some of the people that call into those shows, I feel, are sometimes or maybe one piece of bread short of a sandwich. But I did make a comment one day that really upset everybody. I said, it doesn't matter anymore how good a karate person you are, judo, boxer, wrestler, football player, how good an athlete you might be, how big your neck is, how big your arms are, how much weight you can lift. None of that makes any difference now when somebody can walk up and shoot you in the forehead with a 25 automatic that they can buy for a dollar, maybe $3, tops. So all of that training doesn't really make any difference anymore. Or how good a condition you're in. Well, I really upset coaches, and I upset a lot of different athletes. And it wasn't until the end of the program that they got my point. We have many people that train, and a lot of young people that equate that muscular development or the fact they're a star in football as being tough. It's not like the old days, you know, build yourself up so nobody will kick sand in your face on the beach. Those days are long gone, because now they're saying anywhere from 70, and in some states, 90% of the people that confront you are armed. So they finally got the message, because there are a lot of athletes that are being targeted, sometimes by gangs. I just did the California State Bodybuilding Championships. They wanted me to give a talk because some of their great bodybuilders with 22-inch arms are becoming targets of some people. You get points. You move up in a gang if you kill one of these people. And they're some of the nicest people I've ever met. I mean, they're just like all of us. I mean, they're just normal, and they have an interest, like somebody bowls. You know, maybe next week it'll be somebody that plays tennis. Well, we've already had the Monica Seles thing. So times have really changed, especially in my work. I think now what I'm going to do is move on to the, and we got just the right amount of time here so that I can allow for some questions. I'd like to cover some of the techniques. Now, obviously there are going to be some of you that may not agree with any of these techniques. Some of you may like some of them. Some of you say, well, I'd never do that, or I'd never use this. The only ones I'm talking about today are ones that I know have worked, either for me or people that I've counseled, people that I've worked with. And hopefully, I'll be a happy guy if one of you in here uses a technique and you survive a difficult or serious situation. Number one, especially for the young people that I talk to, just don't get into it. You've got to know when it's time to back off. If you don't get in an argument or a battle with somebody, and you know when to walk away, all the better. You just don't start the battle. You know, if there's nobody around to fight, you know, nothing's going to happen. You kind of end the conflict before it begins. You can use humor. I use humor an awful lot in my work. I've been able to calm people down you can almost see them in their body language, how their shoulders kind of come down by using humor. It's a great way to steer somebody in a more positive direction if they're starting to get upset. And this can even work sometimes on people that are really upset and want to hurt you. I've found over the years that humor has a great calming effect, especially after they laugh. Number three, your mind is a far better weapon than your hands or feet will ever be. You can outsmart many of the people that want to hurt you. And I'm going to go through some of that in the moments ahead. But you can also pretend. You can play games. You can pretend you're sick. You're crazy. You know, all kinds of things. I have one personal example where I wasn't on a bodyguard job. I also worked at some civic centers and worked for two private management companies, one called Spectacor and one called Ogden Allied. And they did a lot of major concerts around the country. And I remember taking a walk in Richmond, Virginia, in an area I should have asked first. But I guess I was walking in a real dangerous area. And this guy started following me. I'd cross the street, he'd cross the street. Well, I'd been in security long enough to know that I was either getting set up for a mugging or robbery, something. And I had been told one time just to try and look as crazy and turn around and start walking toward him. So I'm walking along and suddenly I go, "Hey!" And then I kind of smiled. And I started walking toward the guy. And he just kind of looked at me and it was like, and he took off. And he actually was shaking his head like, "Man, wow, that guy's crazy." And then I went on about my business. And it wasn't until later that I found out that this was really a bad place and that they were the number two murder rate in the country. They had all kinds of tourists that were getting shot in Richmond. Number four, you can agree with the person that's hassling you. Now, this is kind of hard to do. I was talking with some people last night where they weren't sure they could do this because they want to let people know they're mad. You can agree. Somebody calls you a jerk, a bum, you're ugly, whatever. Yeah, you're right. Just agree with them. You never give them an option or an opportunity to get, you know, to carry it on. You kind of end it and you keep walking. And a lot of my techniques, you always want to talk a little bit and keep walking because you're moving into a safer area. Escape has to be your number one goal. I don't want anybody to be duking it out like Bruce Lee and Chuck Norris. All those battles are choreographed. I had a student in the minors group that said, "Well, but can't you kick somebody 15 times? No. You can't punch somebody 12 times and they still get up and want to go have lunch? No. One punch can change your life. It's not 15 kicks. In martial arts, one kick can kill you or seriously injure you. It's as simple as that. Same way with a boxer. Break your neck. If you're not trained, one punch, you can paralyze somebody. Now, you can either paralyze somebody or you can be paralyzed. So when I work with kids, I talk to them about the fact that, you know, have you got any goals? "Oh, yeah, we want to do this. I want to be a pilot. I want to do this." Well, if you're always looking for trouble, there's somebody always there that's going to help you with that. There's always somebody better, faster, quicker, more well-developed, better trained, maybe has different instincts about fighting than you have. But if somebody calls you a name, fine, let them. I've been called every name in the book, and sometimes by people that have no idea what I do for a living. I remember this was kind of a funny situation where I gave a talk at a junior high. They were having, this was in Waverly, Iowa, and at that time I was strictly talking about the martial arts and the discipline and things like that. And after I wore my gi or my uniform to the school, I got in my car after the talk and I'm driving out and my car stalled. Well, there was a guy behind me, and he's going like this, and he's honking, and he's just getting all crazy. So I thought, well, I'll get out and tell him that my car he'll have to go around me. My car won't start. So I get out in this karate uniform, and he's suddenly going, "Ah!" and he's rolling up the window. I think he thought I was, you know, he'd watched too many Chuck Norris movies or something. But I just told him, and he's going, okay, okay, no problem. You know, I think sometimes the movies give the impression that anybody that's in the martial arts must be, you know, it's kick first and ask questions later. Number five, you can change the subject of the conversation. If you feel whatever you're talking about is upsetting somebody, move to a different topic. Very simple. It's worked a lot, especially for teachers. And they'll come back and deal with that problem later. There's always another time. Number six, you can acknowledge the agitated person's feelings. This has worked for me many times, where you just approach somebody and say, hey, that you know is going to cause you a problem. I know you're having a bad day. I know you're really upset. I can tell you're really upset, but I think I've got a way we can work this out. There's a way to get past this. I want you to think for a minute. Take a deep breath. That kind of thing. And it's worked. Again, not for everybody. I'm the first to tell every group I talk to that there are some situations where there is no defense. There is absolutely nothing you can do. I've talked to many women's groups across the country, and in some situations, there was absolutely nothing they could do in their particular situation. I talked with one wife that her husband is very high up in the Farm Bureau Insurance Company, and she was at the sink doing dishes. And a guy came in and put a hood over and cinched it up, just about cut her hair off, and then attacked her over the next few hours. And she felt bad that she had no defense. And I said, don't feel bad. I mean, there was nothing you could do. Even with all this training, a two-week self-defense course would not help, because the guy that attacked her had tremendous upper body strength. He'd already been in prison. He'd already lifted weights for 2.5 years. There was no way a two-week, five-week, 10-week self-defense course was going to work on this guy. The sad part of that situation, and where I really focused my talk, was to take the husband for a walk. And I don't mean like out to the woodshed and, you know, I mean, I had a serious talk with him because he was upset with her. Well, you could have done something. He came in a home with no air conditioning in it. They didn't have air, so she had all the windows open. And he said, well, now I'll probably have to buy air conditioning. I thought it was the most insensitive, one of the most insensitive people I've ever encountered. And he also probably got real tired of listening to me, because I took him on a ride. We went everywhere. I mean, I wouldn't let him out of my truck. I wanted to make sure that he got the message that he was saying all the wrong things to his wife. So another little point is that you can say things like, you're really shaken up about this. You can try and you develop or connect with them. You can try and set up a critical distance zone. What do I mean by that? If, for example, I've got many examples. I'll try and pick one here. There was a professor at Boise State. A student came into his office, really upset, and said, I'm gonna punch you out. I don't like the grade I got, and I've had it with you. Well, first mistake he made was to get up from his desk and come around the desk to confront the guy. That was the first mistake. Second one was, when he did that, he moved away from the phone. Third mistake was that he moved away from the only exit door in the office. The fourth mistake was that he challenged the guy. Do you realize who I am? Do you realize how long I've taught in this school? Do you realize the position, the esteem I have in this college? Well, he didn't care. That was the last thing on his mind. And that's why he got hurt. So you want to try and, when you're dealing with somebody that's really upset and there's that potential that you're not going to be able to calm him down verbally, get something between you and the person that's upset. A couch, chair, a desk, something between you and the person that's upset. Have a little zone of protection. You also want to, and this is another point here, is to try and change the immediate environment. I like to call this my walk and talk method. Somebody's really upset with you and screaming at you and yelling at you, and you can talk with them. Answer them. Say whatever you want, but all the time you're doing that, you're walking. I've actually had people that have followed me right out of the concert hall so that they could be arrested. And they're telling me everything they're upset about and why they hate the judge so much, or why they hate Waylon Jennings or Kenny Rogers. And they're going, and you blankety blankety blank. And I'm going, yeah, okay, you know, and I'm talking to them. They're following me right out. The idea for all of you is that you get to a safer area. You may get to some people that can help you. You can get some attention. None of these guys want an audience. That, you know, that are in these kind of situations that they're trying to assault you. They want to try and get you away somewhere alone. Now, obviously, the person that attacks an entertainer in front of a huge crowd doesn't mind the audience. But for people that usually you'll come in contact with, they're not going to be lurking in bushes. Like in the movies, they're always coming up behind. Most people that you have a conflict with, you may have seen earlier in the day. They may not be a friend, hopefully, but you've seen them before. You may not remember it, but they may have been around you earlier in the day, and they're going to be walking towards you. It's not like in the movies where they're lurking behind the bushes and they're all real ugly and they jump out. And I mean, Ted Bundy actually was very handsome. Many women that survived felt he was really handsome. You know, a knockout, just a great looking guy. And he had the perfect face, that kind of thing. As I said earlier, knowing when to back off. You live to fight or argue or debate another day. Know when it's time to just work on it another day. Let's argue about this later, or debate, or maybe find a solution to it later. Instead of, I will win at all costs. It's not a sporting event when you're in a potentially violent situation where you're trying to one-upmanship somebody. An argument or a conflict can change and go to violence in milliseconds. You also want to trust your instincts. When the hair on the back of your neck raises up, when your stomach gets a little queasy, trust it. More and more people that I've interviewed or that I've met in some of the talks I've given regret not doing that. I think my wife would be the first to admit that in some of the concerts we've worked, my instincts were pretty accurate. Or when I've given talks and a school will have me come in, teachers are amazed that I can pick out the two boys that are the problem. And I think it's just from years of working with people and knowing their body language, their perspiration rate, their eye contact, their hand movements, their body language. So if you feel a little weak in the knees, trust it and then do something. One of the other problems, and I think Ann mentioned this yesterday in her talk about some people that are just paralyzed with evil. It's the same way in an attack situation. I've known people that have had all kinds of training, even military training, that are paralyzed. They almost become catatonic. They freeze in an attack situation. Allow someone that's very angry some space. You know, we've seen it maybe even with the chipmunks, and you know, they have an area where if you get too close, they take off. I had one true story where I did some work with the Ringling Brothers, and I worked with Gunther Gable Williams a few times, and he was having problems even in the civic center business and in the security business because of different rights groups that wanted to hurt him. And again, I don't get involved in their politics. But I was backstage one time, and I was standing by a tiger cage. And I had my back to the cage, and I kept feeling this stuff on the bed, like water, and I thought somebody was squirting me. Well, it was the tiger. I got too close to the cage, and he sprayed his area. It's like, you know, you're in my zone, buddy, get out. In a bad situation, you don't want to get drawn into negative thinking if you can all help it. You've got to really work at it. But you can't really pity yourself or blame yourself for getting in the jam you're in. It's like many of the pilots that have been shot down or whatever and are out there in the middle of nowhere and want to stay out of a prison camp. They start thinking, you know, why me? And many of them that I've read interviews about said that was really destructive. It's like the police officer that's in a gunfight. And he says, why couldn't this have happened on the morning shift? Everything happens on the night shift. And now I've got a battle with three guys coming out of a grocery store. This isn't fair. And a lot of officers said that it was very destructive. And some of them even said that's why they were shot or wounded. It was because they got all caught up in this negative thinking. And when you're in that situation, you want to focus on what you can do to get to safety or outsmart the other person. You've got to really stay focused. The young man that was just on the cover of Time magazine here a while back that got shot down and they had all the parades for, there's a long interview about what he went through, and he said he just had to rid himself of negative thinking. He had to concentrate on how to, you know, use this stealth method more or less and not get caught. If you don't like what you see, leave. It's nearly impossible to be attacked, robbed, or murdered if you're not in the same area as the person who wants to hurt you. Now that seems pretty obvious, but it's alarming to me that so many people, a lot of young people, and more adults are putting themselves in dangerous situations and sometimes think it's, well, I'm a nice person. Nobody want to hurt me. I've always helped people. I'm very religious. I'm just a good person. I'm well liked. Why would anybody want to do this to me? So you want to focus on the fact that where you're at, avoid tunnel vision. A lot of the people that I've interviewed that have hurt other people say they focus on people that aren't aware of people and things around them. That's your best defense. To be more aware. It's not the karate and all that other stuff. It's to be more aware of people and things around you. The other point is don't be afraid to make some noise. You've heard the old story about yelling fire, or you're hurting me as loud as you can, or scream, or break a window. Attract some attention. Let somebody know that things aren't right. They think that the little boy that survived would have undoubtedly been murdered by Wesley Allen Dodd. The reason he's alive today is that coming out of the movie theater in the arms of this predator who had already killed, I think, two other boys, he yelled, you know, Daddy, or leave me alone. You're not my daddy. And some guy went to his aid. And I was a little kid. And adults need to do that too. You need to let people know that things aren't right. Now you can interrupt the flow of events. And what do I mean by that? You can interrupt the flow of violence or what's happening around you by many different techniques. And I guess the first one, and this is probably the most difficult one to demonstrate, is the razzle-dazzle method, but it works. We just met, my wife and I, at a supper party one night, just met a woman that used this in California successfully. But she felt that she was being approached by somebody along the street where she parked her car. And he started moving toward her. And she, I don't know where she had picked it up or from a book, but it was the classic razzle-dazzle where she rather than walk away from the guy, she walks toward him, good eye contact, and goes, are you having a heart attack? You really look bad. You're you're pale. Call 911. And she just started firing, rapid fire at this guy, talking to him, going, you just look terrible. Your eyes are dilated. I mean, Mike, what's wrong? And suddenly the attacker's going, you know, it's kind of messing up his energy and his anger rhythm. And he's kind of going, well, he's starting to answer her. Well, I'm not having a heart attack, you know. And she was able to get away because he finally said, you're crazy. And he was yelling to the people, I'm okay. And this guy had a long history of attacking people. Successfully. But she messed up his anger rhythm. She messed up his attack mode. She really, you know, put a wrench in the works. Another little trick of the trade is, and this is another hard one to convince people, but I have a file on this. And maybe some of you have heard about it, but it does work. I don't know all the reasons on why it works, but it does. And that's to begin praying out loud. They have interviewed some attackers that have wanted to attack not only women, but men. And the man or woman have started praying out loud. And for the attackers, as they've interviewed them after they've been arrested, one of the guys said, you know, it was like going to church with my mom or going to church with my dad. I couldn't get away from her fast enough. You know, it worked. Just to start praying out loud, whatever prayer you want to say. Some people go, oh, you know, that would never work. And it won't. I will tell you in every situation. But then again, it may work in the one situation that you're confronted with. Just begin praying out loud. I had another situation where a woman used this during an attack, and to be real blunt, the man lost all sexual urge. He just wanted to leave the house. It worked. So keep that in mind. You can seek to befriend your opponent's better nature. Even some, and the operative word is some, even some of the most brutal people, the most sadistic, the most torturous people in our land, there are some that you can find that one spark of decency, and you try to connect with that person. I've used this in my work. I'm trying to do that today. I'm trying to connect with all of you here so that you'll understand, you'll listen, and maybe you'll believe what I'm saying and why I feel so strongly about what I do. I'm trying to connect. It can work the same way with an attacker. You can try and start a conversation. Try and get them to start talking. I've got two Apple boxes, and many of the articles that have been sent by my father-in-law of different articles he's cut out of the paper, but there are many examples of where we many times talk too much and listen too little. We get caught up in perceptions, and sometimes you can diffuse a situation by knowing what the real issue is. For example, it's not so important what he thinks. It's not so important what I think. It's what I think he thinks and what he thinks I think that many times causes the problem. We mess up. We see the perceptions incorrectly. Or we kind of guess. Or we just know. I just know he doesn't like me. And he could be totally wrong. I hope I am. When you try to build this quick relationship, I'm the first to say that you're going to be scared to death. But you've got to play a game. Because ultimately, escape is the key. So you've got to kind of play a game with these people. And so it may be kind of phony. But you may say things to really try and make this guy feel good, to get him engaged in a conversation. And many times, there have been countless TV shows, especially on Rescue 911 and different shows like that, where they've depicted people that have been able to talk their attacker out of doing terrible things. You know, and it might work.
Can you give an example of that? Sometime you've done that before?
Well, I've had many different situations where talking and giving somebody a consequence, giving them something to think about. Sometimes you can fire back, do you realize, what'll happen? I had a situation where I had an entertainer here and I had an attacker here, and I'm kind of in the middle of this. And I knew that I was in trouble too, because I thought this guy was armed. So I looked at a third person, and you'll find them in many different situations. In workplace violence, they call it the covert employee. He's the person that likes to stir things up. He doesn't want to get involved in it himself, but he wants to stir. He wants to get things, people battling in the office. And so he's the stirrer. Well, it's the same way in this situation. I had a third party that wanted to see what I was going to do, or what this person was going to do to the entertainer. And so he was just there and saying things to kind of escalate the situation. So I looked at him rather than the bad guy, and I said, "Call an ambulance now." Well, the third guy goes, "Nothing's happened. You haven't done anything." And I said, "Call an ambulance now, because somebody's going to get hurt, and I don't want it to be me." Well, for the first time, the bad guy is not looking at the entertainer anymore, and he's not looking at the covert guy. He's looking at me. And that was the first time I really got his attention, that there was a price to pay for attempting to hurt this entertainer. There was a consequence. And he thought about it, and he backed off. Now, in a home situation, sometimes you can try and reach their inner core, their psyche, by trying to build a relationship. Do you need money? What can I do? Why do you need to hurt me? If it's money you want, I can help you out. And again, you're building time, maybe for help. But for some people, you can find that ray of hope where they will listen to you, and they'll give you that time, and then they'll back off, and maybe they'll decide just to take your stereo and they're out the door. I was asked, we lived in Las Vegas for a short time, and I was contacted by a group that do peaceful demonstrations, the peacemakers. And they demonstrate, for example, at the Nevada test site and for various other causes. And they asked me to talk with them a little bit about what are some ways to keep, for example, security guards and police officers, maybe during the time they're demonstrating, from hurting them. And I remember they even gave me a little card, and it was from a person named Gertrude Stein. Oh. And the card said, "Considering how dangerous everything is, nothing is really very frightening." I always kept that. But I told them that one of my favorite techniques to keep your attacker or your opponent off guard a little bit, or maybe to maybe back off a little bit, is to talk, to be able to converse, to try and engage them in conversation. And maybe you can help them picture or view the situation a little differently. Now, sometimes during a violent situation, as I said before, we talk too much and listen too little. We don't really sometimes know how to listen. We're always thinking about what we're going to say next, and we're not really hearing what people are saying. And there have been many situations where, once I understood what the problem was, I could provide an option. Sometimes people are upset at an entertainer, and really it's not the entertainer they should be upset with. And I try to calm them down, and they decide, well, okay, I won't stab whoever. And then at least you can get them to another area and then deal with them there. To attempt or to try to handle potentially violent situations non-violently, you got to be courageous. When I talk with kids, I try to help them understand that you really, you must want not to fight. You've really got to work at it, because it's a lot easier to hit someone than it is to try and negotiate a peaceful solution. And so you've really got to work at it, and you got to, you know, work on your temper. And the younger you do that, the younger you can control your temper, that's going to pay dividends for you throughout your life. It's going to help you, especially when you're an adult. The key point that I try to tell every group that I talk to or try to share is that hopefully we all know that life is precious. And for young people, they've got their whole life ahead of them. I want all of them to reach whatever goals they may seek. But you can't do it if you're looking for trouble. Because as I said earlier, there's always somebody out there that will fill that bill. They'll help you out. They'll fight you. They'll hurt you. What I'd like to do now is open it up to any questions that you might have. In this time period, it's kind of hard to cover every aspect of conflict or anger or conflict resolution or de-escalation and all that. So I just kind of thought I'd touch on the high points and also have a laugh or two, because this can be a heavy subject. Some teacher groups that I talk to get really frustrated. They get depressed. They get angry because they're even having to deal with this. You know, it's like, I didn't get into teaching to have to worry about somebody with a knife or a gun in my classroom. And I understand that, and so I kind of take it easy. We kind of gradually move into how teachers can better protect themselves and what to do and what not to do, and how administrators, for many of them, it's sometimes just knowing when to back off a little bit and maybe deal with the problem later, or remove the person from the area for a while and let everybody cool down. Yes?
What's your feeling on carrying these protective sprays, these NAFTA sprays?
I was asked that last night down in the pool hall. Not that they'd ever use them down there. I mean, it wasn't like somebody saying, I really need some down here, or Wes might need some, I don't know. I tell people that the problem with sprays is that I've had several people that have sprayed themselves. You got to make sure the nozzle is pointed toward the bad guy. The other thing is wind drift. Many people have got caught trying to spray an attacker, even the Postal Service, trying to spray dogs. And the wind is, you know, and then they get bitten anyway. Or drug around for a while. There was one guy that, I think it was a... I can't think of the name. It starts with an R. Rottweiler that drug the postal guy into the backyard. And he tried, you know, he was still trying to spray him, but he kept spraying himself. The other thing is, don't leave them in your car, because many of them explode and you don't know it. And then you get in the car and you're driving and you crash somewhere. So if you get one, buy two. Practice with one. And then keep the other one with you. I don't tell people not to buy that stuff, but you've got to train with it. You can't just buy it, have it somewhere, and think, well, I've got it now. You know, everything's okay, because there are some that are duds. There have been several interviews with people. In fact, they're suing a company right now because there was a woman being accosted in San Francisco, and when she sprayed, it kind of went. You know, and it just upset the guy, you know, even more, you know. Yes?
Have you heard of a school in New York, I can't remember the name of it now, but they do a lot of work with violence in the school and just dealing with anger right from the start, with sort of the horsing around stuff and physical contact.
Yes.
That, you know, might be play and then very quickly turns to anger. And there, it seems like this show I saw about it, they were doing a lot of work with just really setting limits for people kind of horsing around and getting in. I was wondering if you knew any
yes,
more about
the atrium. Okay. They won the Ben Franklin Award, yeah. I think, for several of their books. And I was introduced to that through my father-in-law, who's sitting right behind you. But I wrote them. And I've got several of their books. I support their program. the younger the better, to find ways to debate, to negotiate, mm-hmm. ways to handle bullies. I think that is great. The earlier the better. But I really like their program, I like their techniques, and I especially like the fact that the founder, and some people don't know this, is a master in karate. But also a professor. He's written 7 or 8 books. He won 2 or 3 Ben Franklin Awards for outstanding books for children. But he's a very nonviolent. One of the keys about karate is that it was founded by an elementary school teacher, or really introduced to the Western world by an elementary school teacher by the name of Gichin Funakoshi. One of my other masters, Masoyama, has spent most of his life helping the poor and the homeless. And a very nonviolent person. The last thing he would ever want to do is hit someone. And many of these people will tell you the highest skill in karate is defeating or subduing your enemy without the use of force. You don't need to battle, that kind of thing. But I've read the program. I like some of their walking away techniques, helping young people understand that because you're called something, you don't have to get caught up in this ego thing, or the fact that somebody calls you a name in front of your friends, you don't have to immediately defend your honor, that it's okay, that you can walk away and still be a good person, that kind of thing. But yes, I support the program. Yes?
Do you take any special precautions if the person attacking you has a handgun?
That's probably would be one of the more difficult questions I get. Whenever a firearm is introduced, you've got a serious problem, and that's obvious. Unless you have years of training in the martial arts, or years of training through the military, to try and disarm that person, forget it. Many experts, including J.J. Bittenbinder, who's on the Oprah show all the time, but he is a truly wonderful detective in the Chicago Police Department. I mean, just because he's on Oprah or whatever, or does talk shows, doesn't lessen the fact that he's a great detective. And he says that you have a better chance of running from that weapon, better odds than you do in Las Vegas. That many of these people are nervous or high, and that he has many examples of people that have not been hit at all or have been wounded but still able to escape. His point is, when somebody's got a gun and they want you to get into a car or a truck, don't. Once you do that, you're going to be out in some ditch somewhere. He says you've got to resist and not get in the vehicle. He doesn't care a lot of other stuff you do, but don't get in the vehicle. Yes?
But do you wear a bulletproof vest?
No.
No.
And I'm pretty direct about why. Every bodyguard, not just almost every, but almost, well, every bodyguard that I know in the last 26 years, mm-hmm. whether in this country or in a foreign country, because I've had friends that have worked in different Latin American countries and in Europe, all are shot in the head or the throat. So they know, they can tell many times who the bodyguard is, and that's many times the first person they're going to take out. And they just assume that you're wearing a vest. I have many friends that are, you know, have been bodyguards for years that don't wear a vest. And I've had people say, well, you should, and I've worked with people that own bulletproof vest companies that have designed newer ones now that are lighter and easier. But I used to be real heavy, heavier than I am now. And to put on a vest, I tried it a few times, and I couldn't see anything because I was sweating so much. My glasses would fog up, and I was kind of walking around. And that's not good in my work. I hope I answered the handgun question. If you're taking a 2 or 5 week self-defense course, or even a 2-year course, the chances of you successfully defending against a firearm are probably 0, and that's it. You know, you're lucky, because on an automatic, you've got to know where to grab. And like the Secret Service agent, when they were trying to shoot President Ford, he had one opportunity, because it was a loader. And that 45 was ready to go. There was one in the chamber. And he knew how to grab that automatic to keep the slide, to keep the action from working. The same way on a revolver, to keep the cylinder from turning. But you've got to have a tremendous grip, I'm telling you. You have got to do the old grip exercises, and these guys are always training. I've got one of these little hand things that I work on. You only have one chance, usually. And if you have a bad day or mess up, you're shot. The other thing is give them what they want, but don't get in the car. You know, if they want money out of your ATM, man, give them all your cards here, and I'll give you all the codes. Whatever you want, you've got it. Sometimes people say take your billfold out and your keys if they want your car and throw it 20 feet. Well, they're going to go over and get that and you can pew, exit stage left.
Yes, you said that there were some questions the miners asked, but that was already...
Well, I was going to end on that, and then I thought, well, I'm probably going too long here and it's about ready to eat. But one of the girls from Minnesota came up to me and said... You know, I really enjoyed your talk. Well, obviously that made me feel real good, real warm. And she said, you know, Holden is such a special place, a beautiful place. I love Holden. And I was listening. And she said, you know, but Friday, I've got to go back to Minneapolis. I go to an inner city school. I had a teacher, one of my favorite teachers, shot to death in a classroom. We've got kids that are doing all kinds of things. Minneapolis now is getting on the map for an increase in the murder rate. And she was talking to me like Dan Ratherwood or Sam. I worked with Sam Donaldson a few years ago. That was a real treat. But I'm sorry I said that. Don't sell me. It was such a profound series of statements from a 15-year-old, and I thought she made a tremendous comment. I had someone that asked me how my family feels about this work, and obviously they're real happy that I'm getting out of it. I think my daughter finally realized the kind of work when she saw the movie The Bodyguard or In the Line of Fire. I don't think before that she really understood what Dad did, off and on, or part time or full time, or because I've had other jobs too. But I think she'll be real happy, and I know my wife will be, and we're hoping that the workshop and seminar area will develop.
Yes. Yeah, on the lighter vein.
Yeah.
The other day when you were visiting with me. And you were wearing your dark glasses. And I was, you know, now you're not wearing one, everything, because you're looking at us. And so you mentioned why you wear dark glasses. And I never ever thought of it. And I think that's interesting.
Well, there are really two or three reasons. But one is if you wear the gargoyles, or these aren't gargoyles. I've got a set of those, too. But the mirrored... I can be looking over here right now, but body, the body style right now, or my head is positioned here, peripheral vision, so I can see somebody moving on this side, and they think I'm looking this way, and sometimes that's helped me to still be around. One of the other reasons is sometimes for appearance. If you walk into a room. And you've got on your suit coat, and you've got your mirrored glasses, and they want you to slick your hair back. You kind of look like Kamikaze Man, And so when you get real, I can't do it now. I'm smiling, but when you get really upset, or you send a message that you're upset, sometimes that's all it takes. I mean, sometimes in some situations, when I haven't wanted to get into a situation, just going, "Jay!" is enough for people to go, "Man, that guy is out to lunch." Now, it's just enough to get attention. In some of my self-defense classes, I work with both men and women to learn sometimes how to just let it out, that primal scream or whatever. And in some situations, it's worked great. because most attackers that I've interviewed want somebody they can dominate, someone they can control, someone they can intimidate. I noticed some of you moved when I did that, and I'm just having a good time today. Yes.
Those screamers that look like the mace things where yeah. you press it and it screams, are they better than the...
They've been effective, especially in cases where somebody is jogging, where you're out and about and eating the little horn,
right, yeah.
or if you want to attract attention, especially in situations where you've got carjackers. Sometimes the horn has been able to scare everybody away because people start looking. So I would have really nothing bad to say. Plus, they've got some new ones now that are... They're a little longer than there's a lot that are about like this. There's some now that are about like this. And I tell you, I don't know how many decibels, but I just thought when I yelled, this poor guy in the sound room is probably. But they really work. And they actually can hurt people. I mean, people go like this, the bad guy, you know. But it also attracts attention. Any other questions you might have? Yes.
I don't know what you have to say about this, but you mentioned having it's important to have a positive mentality, and I was thinking, I guess it's the mentality of escape. If you're faster than the other person, if there's an open door, think you can outrun them, but it isn't, how do you do that and have a positive mentality? I mean, that almost seems to me like a fight or flight type of fearful way of approaching the situation.
Well, but you'll be alive, maybe.
Okay.
The fight or flight mechanism is kind of a basic that most people have, and what I try to do is get them beyond that. For so many people, they felt they have to fight. If their honor, they don't want to be a chicken. They don't want people making fun of them, that kind of thing. They just got to fight. But I try to get them past that and maybe look at other options and to try and stay positive so that you're focused on survival. Obviously, that's what I want you to do is survive. Unless you have all this training and you feel lucky and you can duke it out with somebody and survive. Any other time to eat? Thank you very much.